is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is T.K. Griffith, boys head varsity basketball coach at Archbishop Hope in High School, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years, and now with its integrated web platform, coaches have the ability to add video to plays and share them directly to their players' Android and iPhones via their mobile app. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. In addition to a great product, they also provide basketball coaching content and resources through their blog and PlayBank. For access to these plays and more information, visit FastModelSports.com or follow them on Twitter at FastModel.
If you do what you do and you do that well, it doesn't matter what the other team does.
Lewis Schein is the author of Defense, Keys to Becoming a Top Defensive Team. Lewis most recently coached at Winthrop University as the associate head coach of the women's basketball team for the 2018-2019 season. Prior to Winthrop, Schein coached at Central State University, a Division II school in the Southern Intercollegiate Athletic Conference, where he was part of two 20-game winning seasons, including an 18-5 record as the acting head coach during the 2017-2018 season. Schein has also served as a personal trainer since 2005, training athletes on all levels, including professional, collegiate, high school, and junior high. In 2011-2012, Lewis was the PR and marketing director for the Lima Explosion, a member of the American Basketball Association. During the 2012-2013 season, he served as the general manager of the team as well as the head coach. From 2013 to 2016, Schein was the owner and general manager of his own minor league basketball team, the Lima Express, that spent the first 2 years of its existence playing in the PBL. During the team's inaugural season, Schein was named co-executive of the year, and in the third season of the team's existence, it moved up to play in the Midwest Professional Basketball League. Schein received his bachelor's degree in health and sports science in 2002 from Miami University. In his first year in Oxford, Schein walked on to the Miami Redhawk basketball team and was a member of the 1998 team under the late, great Charlie Coles that went on to be one of the greatest basketball teams in school history. Under the on-court leadership of NBA lottery pick Wally Szczerbiak, they went on to win the 1998-1999 MAC championship and reached the NCAA tournament Sweet 16. We recently launched the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Our roster of shows is growing, so don't forget to check out all our other podcasts on the Hoopheads Pod Network, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, the Green Light podcast, and our team-focused NBA pods, Cavalier Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, 305 Culture, Blazing the Path, Hashtag Lakers, Motor City Hoops, X's and O's NBA Breakdown, Spanning the Spurs, LA Hoops, Thunderous Applause, and the Wizards Hoops Analyst. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Email us info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. We're talking defense, so grab your notebook as you listen to this episode with Coach Lewis Schein. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Coach Lewis Schein, the author of Keys to Becoming a Top Defensive Team. And we're going to dive a little bit into Lewis's book, get the why behind the reason he wrote the book, and what he hopes to accomplish and what he can help you to accomplish as a coach. So Lewis, let's start out with why write this book? What inspired you to do it? What value did you think you could bring to other coaches through coming up with this book?
Well, first off, I just want to thank you for having me on again. You know, I had a great time being on the last episode that I did with you guys back last year. And so just an honor to be on, man. And, you know, thanks for letting me talk about my book, man. It's Defense, Keys to Becoming a Top Defensive Team. And defense has always been a passion for me. You know, even when I played college, played pro, you know, I wasn't always I like to say I was one of the best offensive players, but the truth is I had a lot of dogs on my team, like high major D1 players, Cal, LSU, Colorado State. Like, so there were some guys that it was like, okay, for you to get your minutes and to be a part of this team in a major way, I had to shift to something that I knew I could control every possession, you know, going down on the defensive end, and that's defense. You know, I didn't have to have the ball to be a great defensive player. And so, you know, a lot of it stemmed from then. And then when I had the opportunity to start coaching in college, you know, I used a lot of the principles that I learned, that I taught in the pros, that I did as a player in the pros, and I put those things to use. And I had an opportunity as a Division II coach. The first year I was a Division II coach, I was an assistant coach. And then my head coach took a leave of absence, and I had an opportunity to become the acting head coach. And so, you know, I further put some of my principles in, and we had some great results that year. You know, we're top 10 in the nation in several categories, and a few of those were defensive categories. And, you know, we did a lot of what we did on purpose. It wasn't it didn't happen by accident. You know, we purposed to do it, and things happened because we put things into practice to make it happen. And so with this season being, you know, just very strange for a lot of coaches, you know, with everything that's going on, and me going through several interviews in the off season and I'm not being able to get back into coaching for this particular season, you know, I wanted to stay relevant in the game, and I wanted to stay helping coaches and just doing what I can to contributing to the game, you know, in my way. And so was in the shower one day, and this kind of came to me. So why don't you put something together? And defense is kind of my thing and where I've had that success as a college basketball coach. So I started writing, man, and here I am on the other side of an ebook.
That's very cool. I think anybody who has sat down to try to write anything, the fact that somebody can crank out a book, you know, it's difficult. I know I've spent a lot of time, probably it's been now since I started the podcast, I haven't written nearly as much, but prior to that, I spent probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 years writing a blog and coming up with ideas and writing coherently and making sure that I had the things that I wanted to say and getting that down on paper. It's definitely a process, and it's something that anybody who can put pen to paper and come up with a book that is compelling and that has value like yours does, I have a lot of respect for anybody who can do that. So when we look at your book, and one of the things that you just touched on, which I think is really, really important, and you mentioned it when you talked about thinking of yourself kind of as an offensive player, but then really realizing that, hey, I got to be a defensive player if I want to be able to play. And I think that's one of the things that when I think about my own playing career, when I think about opportunities that players that I've seen as a coach try to take advantage of their opportunity to get out on the basketball floor, I see far fewer players than I would like to believe that really adopt that defensive mentality and say, I mean, everybody likes to be a great offensive player. Everybody wants to be that high scorer, the person that gets to take all the shots. But the reality is that if you're a player, you should want to be out on the floor playing. And sometimes you got to figure out what that role is that your coach needs you to play. And I can almost guarantee that if there are any players out here listening, or for all our coaches that are in our audience, if you can impress upon your players, or if you're a player yourself, just become a defensive player, commit to it, have that kind of mentality, and you're going to get great results. And I think that that's what I heard you say off the opening, is that you just decided, hey, I'm going to be a defensive player. And once you decide you're going to be a defensive player, now I've got something. And I think that's the same thing when you talk about coaching and you talk about this book. You're saying, hey, here's some things that I've learned over the course of my career as both a player and a coach that can help you to hang your hat on a defense. And so let's go into the book and talk a little bit more about it. Give me an idea. The first section in the book just kind of gives your background and talks a little bit about some of the things that you said. You mentioned in there that you used to watch the LA Lakers growing up in California, and that your guy was Michael Cooper. So why was Michael Cooper your guy?
Man, listen, it's hard to pick one player off of that team. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
He stuck out to me over time, because when I looked on the court, when they would square up against guys like Jordan, who's guarding Jordan? Michael Cooper. You know, like he was guarding the best player on the other team. And you know, nowadays you see a lot of players, except for the Mikes and those type of players that are like two-way players, they're not guarding the best player. But you get this guy, Michael Cooper, and he's like sixth man, but he's guarding the best player and not backing down. And he's not Magic. He's not Kareem. He's not getting those kind of points, although he's getting some points, but he's playing both ways, and he's not afraid to back down. He's guarding Dr. J, you know? And so I just took a liking to him, man. And I think that any kind of player that plays both ways, it wins my heart automatically, because basketball is not a one-way sport. You know, it's not a sport where you just focus on your offense all the time. You have to play defense by default, because you're on the court. You're going to play defense. And to see somebody like Michael Cooper take pride in it, to me, that just kind of it just hit me in my heart. It's like, you know what? That's the kind of player you got to be.
Yeah, I think being a two-way player, if you're a coach, the more two-way players you can have and the more versatile players that you can have on your team and that you can put out on the court for your team is going to give you a better chance for success. The next section in your book, full court press, and I've been a player and a coach, and I'm not sure that my athleticism always allowed me as a player to be the type of player that would be in a full court pressing on a full court pressing team. But I know that I had the desire to be able to play. And as a coach, I definitely am right with you in terms of having a full court press in your bag, and something that if you can do it and you can teach your kids and you can teach your team how to do it, it can be super effective and it can wear down opponents. And I grew up, Lewis, watching the Kevin Mackey Cleveland State 1986 run and stun team with Mouse McFadden and Clinton Ramsey and all these guys that just went up, Clinton Smith, and went up and down the floor, and he just brought waves and waves of guys. And for people who remember that team, they upset Indiana in the NCAA tournament. And so that was kind of my dad was a professor at Cleveland State, so I watched that team, and I watched Kevin Mackey coach that team, and they just pressed relentlessly for 40 minutes. And I remember coming out of that as I was probably in junior high and then into high school, and just thinking, man, that's the way that I would want to play as a player, and that's the way that I would want to play as a coach. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, your philosophy behind why you believe so much in the full court press, and then we can get into maybe a little bit of the X's and O's piece of it.
Yeah, sounds good, man. So I was fortunate to come up through being in those kind of systems. You know, I was glad I did, because if it was any way other way, I probably wouldn't have, you know. So, you know, I can remember far back as high school, even junior high, but high school, we had a full court pressing team. We pressed the entire game. And so just bringing the story from there, I knew that I wanted to be on the court. I was a starter, but I wanted to be the kind of player that if my coach needed me the entire game, I wanted to be in that kind of shape. So number one, I took pride in my conditioning. I did conditioning outside of the regular practice or what the coach required. And so I knew if coach needed me the entire game and we were pressing the entire game, he didn't have to worry about me being tired. And so we were pressed the entire game. My AAU teams pressing the entire game. And I saw how we gave teams fits. I mean, forcing turnovers left and right. Like it worked. You know, we didn't do much pressing when I was at Miami, Ohio. But we did do some different types of defensive things there. But then, you know, moving on from there, anytime I had an opportunity to coach a team, I always was a fan of the full court press just because of the results that I seen as a player. And then, so I took liking to full court pressing teams. And so when I had my opportunity to put it into play, I surely did it, you know. And so the philosophy there is if it's a part of defense and it's going to make it hard for the other team to get into their offensive flow, then I'm going to do it. And with the full court press, it's probably the number one thing to disrupt an opponent's offense because it's right up front. You know, they start their offense when they inbound the ball. And so my number one thing is I'm not going to let them inbound the ball. But also I talk in the chapter that even before they inbound the ball, And this is just, you know, I'm a chess type of, you know, coach, and I'm going to play it like I'm playing chess. And so offensive rebounds were a big deal to me. And even before you sit in your press, if you learn to become an offensive rebounding team, what that's going to do is it's going to allow for you to not only on the offensive end get more baskets, but it's going to give you more opportunities to set up in your press. You know, if you're getting one and outs and, you know, you're just shooting and missing and then the other team gets it and goes down the court, that's a possession that you're not going to be able to set your press up in. But if you're missing shots and you're getting second opportunities, that's going to give you more opportunities to set up in your press when you make baskets. And so we were number four when I was a D2 head coach, we were number four in the nation in offensive rebounding because we put a premium on it. And because, you know, that helped us set up our press more. And so now once we get in the press, we want to disrupt, you know, with the shot clock, we want to disrupt teams. And even if they get past us without us getting a turnover in that half court setting, it's taken at least 8 to 10 seconds off the shot clock. And now it's going to speed up their offense because now they have less time to get through their progression, get through their looks and try to score. But before they get to the half court, when they first take it out, our goal was to get a steal. We were going for steals and we knew it. It wasn't a mystery. That's what we were going to do. And anytime you have a team that not only scores on offense, but can use their defense to score, it's like a two-headed monster, and it's hard for any team to deal with.
Yeah, I think one of the quotes that I love in the book that you have is says, if they are always thinking about how to beat your press, it's very hard to put a lot of thought into their own game plan. And I think that's totally true as a coach. And I think this is especially true at the high school level and below where teams don't always handle pressure in the same way. Not that, again, a college press – you would expect that college teams are at least a little bit better prepared and have more time to prepare for an opponent's press. But in high school, even now with the more sophisticated scouting with video and the things that are available to high school coaches, it's still when you're dealing with high school players or when you go below that level and you start talking about middle school or youth basketball, when you have a team that's pressing you and you're trying to figure out how to break that press and you've totally then gone away from what it is that you're trying to do. It's like, we just don't want to turn the ball over in the backcourt and give up layups. And then once we get the ball across half court, then we got to decide, do we continue on an attack? Do we pull it back out and try to set up whatever offense it is that we run? And so I think that was a line that stuck out to me in the book is, yeah, when you're pressing, when you can get inside someone's head with that pressure, then you totally take them out of what it is that they're trying to do. And they have to play faster maybe than they want to. And then before you know it, you have the pace going and you're able to dictate tempo to the other team. So to me, that's completely, I think, one of the most important things about a press. Now let's talk about the mechanics of a pressing defense. And I know in the book you talk about your favorite press being a 1-2-2. Just explain why you like the 1-2-2 as opposed to some other setups that you might have and what advantages you think that gives a team when they're set up in a 1-2-2 full court press.
Well, I have done some man pressing. So, you know, that's I definitely will do that. The man press, you can create havoc off of that. But at some point, it's going to single it out to be one-on-one. And so with that, I like the 1-2-2 because it's a zone press. It can have some man principles, but what it does is it creates in the backcourt more opportunity to not only trap, but it creates more opportunity for turnovers. And one of the reasons is because when you have your three in the backcourt, you have your two players across half court, you know, they're normally guarding the bigs that are in the front court. I had a fast team and a highly athletic team. And so I was able to teach my team how to guard 4-on-3. So we would have four players pretty much in the backcourt against their three. And I would teach my one player how to guard two people in the front court. So if the ball did get over our heads and pass half court, we had a athletic enough team to get back before they could make a move or get a 2-on-1. We were able to disrupt that. And so it created major disadvantages in the backcourt to where we got a lot of steals. And, you know, four defenders with three offensive players, you would think you should win every time. And so we created that type of situation a lot. And it caused us to not only force turnovers, but there were a lot of unforced turnovers just because of mistakes, because they didn't know our coverages. But also another reason with the 1-2-2 is it was a perfect mirror to a 3-2 in the half court, which we did a lot of 3-2 zone. And so when I had my player's position, you know, the point person, their responsibility was to pretty much shadow the inbounder, make it hard for the inbounder to see. And then once the ball, if it got in, they were able to guide the offense one direction, one side of the floor. But also, once they got the ball across half court, and I like to say if they get the ball across half court.
Right, there you go.
Then that point person is also the point person in the 3-2 zone. So it was a perfect mirror.
Hey, hoopheads. We all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's ARYSE.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
What type of player do you like to put at that? Who's the ideal positional type or characteristics are you looking for that player who's playing the point on either the 1-2-2 full court or the 3-2 half court? Are you putting a big, rangy, athletic guy? Or are you putting your quick point guard there? What do you prefer in terms of the guy that mans that position?
I like for it to be my longest, most athletic person, because when we're in the full court, if they're long, athletic, they can move, They can disrupt the inbounder, the way they pass, influence that. That's a problem right there. So you're going to always have that tall person. So normally that could be your three. It may even be your four, depending on your personnel and who's quicker, who's more athletic or whatnot, who's quicker on their toes. So we had a couple of players that were like that. And because of that, they were agile enough and were able to move. And so I would have that same player at the top of the 3-2 as well, because that point position, once the ball is rotated, you know, sometimes that point position would drop to the high post. And so you have that cross court pass that could be hard, especially with us. We taught that player how to intercept passes, you know, how to duck under the defense. And they were able to even, you know, make up for mistakes, because when they were kind of out of position, they were able to get back in position quickly. And you wouldn't even be able to tell because of how athletic they were. So that's the kind of player I would like to have in that position.
Makes sense. All right. One of the things that I know when you talk about a 1-2-2 press and you think about trying to get that initial trap below the foul line in a full court situation, and there are some coaches that have the philosophy that you just keep trying to get as many traps as you can once you have that team kind of pinned down in their backcourt. And then there's other coaches who say once they get that ball out of that first trap, we're kind of out of the press and we're running back to our half-court defense. Which one of those philosophies would you say aligns more closely with what you believe?
I would probably say, well, I guess I could kind of explain. I guess I could explain mine.
Sure, go for
it. It's a little different.
Okay.
But when that first pass came in, when that trap happened, the next pass was a steal for us. We were going for the steal. You know, of course, we didn't always get it. But instead of letting it be the philosophy of, well, if this happens or if they get out of it or whatever, we set up kind of steps that would almost ensure a steal would happen. And if it didn't, we would deal with it when it went the way that we didn't want it to. But when the first pass came in, we wanted to get that trap. And so that meant our two players, the top player and let's say the strong side, you know, the left player, when we got that trap, the goal there was to be so close on the player and wide at our base that we make the player turn their back. So now, once the player turns their back, there's a few things that's happening there. Number one, they turn their back. They can't get the long pass that's going to go over our head, because remember what I said earlier, we wanted 4-on-3. So that meant there was only one back with two offensive players. So we wanted that player to turn their back so they couldn't see the long pass. So with that concept, we're taking away the long pass. That's why we can have one player back there. So now you have an offensive player with the ball, with their back turned. We're trying to impede their sight line so they can't see in order to make a good pass. So now when they're looking down the line, we have a defender there that's stopping that down the line, the sideline pass. And then the pass back, we have another defender there to get that inbounder, stop the inbounder from getting the ball. And then we have the other defender that, instead of being back guarding two people, we got that person back that's making the 4-on-3. They're the center fielder. So literally it's creating disadvantages everywhere. And that's kind of our philosophy. We were going for the steal. And in my mind, we created it to where we're trying to get the steal and we're trying to set up ways to ensure that a steal will happen, versus setting up so many ways to say, hey, if they break the press, then we're going to do this. We were really athletic. So if they were to break the press, we knew that they were not going to break the press with a home run pass. So if they got a pass back to the inbounds passer, we can just shift. And now they have to decide what they're going to do from there. So we were kind of more offensive in our defensive approach. We were coming at you versus kind of reacting to what you do. We wanted to make you do something based on what we were doing.
How do you instill that mentality in your team? Because I think one of the things that makes for a successful pressing team is just the mentality of they just keep coming at you and keep coming at you and coming at you. And even though, yeah, occasionally they get beat and give up a layup at the other end, because you're going to be in the passing lanes and because you're going to be putting pressure on the ball handler, because you're going to be committing two guys to the ball, you're going to give up some things by doing that. But at the same time, as you said, you're going to create and force tempo. You're going to create steals. But I think the most effective pressing teams that I've ever seen are teams that just have that mentality. So I'm curious, as a coach, how do you go about trying to install that mentality, that aggressiveness that's needed in order for you to be a good pressing team? What does that look like day in and day out in terms of teaching points?
Man, it's fun to talk about, and we could talk 5 hours on this, honestly. But man, it really starts in the preseason. And honestly, it actually starts as soon as the last season ends. So the season before I came acting head coach, we lost in the conference tournament championship to go to the NCAA tournament. We didn't get an at-large bid, so that was a lot of fuel for us then. And so I started a countdown in the office like the very next day. So when players came in for their exit meetings, you know, I was like 364 days to the championship game, you know? So you're kind of getting that thing going in their head. And so then on the defensive end, man, so many things, but I'll just pick a few. You know, it starts with I would bring my players in and I would show them clips of whether it was Michael Jordan or Kobe, full court pressing. There's a famous one with Kobe. He's full court pressing Dwayne Wade. You know, there's the one where Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen locked up Tony Kukoc in the Olympics. Like, just I would feed them that kind of stuff and show them like the best people that do it. I'm showing them clips of what they're doing and how they're creating havoc. So I'm feeding that into the mentality. We will have film sessions. We will open film sessions up with clips like that. When I meet with my guards, I'll show them that, feeding that kind of stuff into them. Then throughout the season, you know, as the season starts, we're looking at teams like Ashland and the top teams in the country. And we're saying we're going to take that spot. So as we progress during the season and we were top 10 in steals, we putting those things in the locker room and putting them up and circling them. And then we're celebrating them. And we had a few players that were, you know, top in the nation in steals on that team. We're celebrating them and we're constantly talking about it and we're constantly keeping it before their eyes. So it's not like a mystery and it's not like a oops. Oh, hey, guess what? We're in top 10. No, we were going after it. And so in practice, we had to do things on purpose in order for that to happen. So it's kind of like shooting the ball. If you're going to increase the percentage, you're going to get them on a Dr. Dish machine or something like that and get shots up in an individual workout. You're trying to improve their percentage. So in practice, if I wanted steals, we had to directly work on that. So I had to show them how to shoot passing lanes, how to deny the ball, how to sit under the defense so the offensive player that has the ball, they in their eyesight, they don't see you because you're ducking away. But you can read what they're doing and you can telegraph their passes. They're telegraphing their passes and you can see that. So you know how to step into the passing lane. So we had a number of things just as if you're working on your offense. We worked on our defense and we worked on steals. And so that kind of fed us. That helped us. And on top of that, we built that because we knew that if we're going to have a full court pressing team that did that all game, then we knew we had to be in some crazy, crazy shape. You know, so our conditioning aided what we were going to do on the court. So our players knew and understand that if we wanted a certain type of result, then we had to work out and condition a certain type of way. And they bought into that. And we were chasing a championship. I mean, to conclude, in the end, anything that we passed out that year had a national championship trophy on it. We were that year I was acting head coach. We were literally chasing that. We knew how far we had came the last year. We felt that if we got into the tournament, we would have did some damage. And so we said this year, you know what, we're going to go for it all and let the chips fall where they may. And we knew that defense was going to carry us there. So
there was just a lot of different things tied together that kind of drove us and kind of kept that thing in front of us and in front of the players. And because of that, the results, you know, that's why they happened. And our players bought into it because we fed that into them. And they just, they understood what we were trying to do and they bought into it.
I think what I hear you saying is that you have to have a mentality that's out there every single day and you have to be intentional. You have to put an emphasis on it. And if you put an emphasis on it and it's something that you talk about, it's something that you recognize, it's something that you celebrate, then you can start to get your players to buy in. And that, I'm sure, doesn't happen in a day. It doesn't happen in 2 days. But as you said, when you start it the day after your season finishes and you're already pointing towards next year's championship game, that gives you an opportunity to be able to utilize all those days that you have ahead of you to instill that mentality that's going to be needed if you're really going to be able to be a team that full court presses. You mentioned a couple times conditioning and how important conditioning is if you're going to be a pressing team. And I don't think there's any question that if you're going to get up and down the floor offensively and defensively, that you've got to be in optimal condition. So when you think about a conditioning program, and let's focus on in season rather than out of season, because then we could dive into a whole, you know, that could be a whole nother podcast. But yeah, let's just focus on in season. What are some things that you would like to build into your practices that help to increase your players' conditioning? Were there specific things that you were doing that somebody could easily identify as, oh, this is when they're going through and they're doing their conditioning? They're doing their traditional wind sprints, or they're doing their whatever, weightlifting, or they're doing their plyometrics. There's that piece of it, but then there's also building it into some of the drills and just the way you run your practices. So just talk a little bit about how you condition your team to be a full court pressing team during the season.
Yeah. So, man, like you said, we could talk for days on this stuff, man. But, preseason was one thing, and maybe we could talk about it another time, but it's so key because during the season, you can't slack off, but you also can't work them to the bone where it is preseason. You know, in season, you have to kind of watch it a little bit. And one of my things was I built the conditioning into the drills. So it wasn't like the sprints and different things we did in the preseason. You know, you don't want to wear a player out like that. That's to prepare. But in season is more maintaining. You know, because, you know, preseason was, I want to get them to a certain level. Now that we're in season, it's okay, we don't want that to drop. So we would do things like, we would do, when we open practice, we would do certain drills, but our conditioning was in those drills, full court layups. You had to go game speed, those type of things, keeping the momentum up. We would also do a lot of drills where they were competition drills and the losers had to run sprints, you know? So not only does that allow for the players to have to play harder because they want to win whatever the competition is, you know, if you lose, you have to run. So it's kind of a double whammy type of thing. But a lot of times we would have players that would, you know, if they lost the drill, they run, you would get sometimes the players that won, they would jump in there and run with them just because they had our goals on the forefront of their mind. Another thing that worked for me, man, was I was a type of coach where I always try to lead by example. And so me, at the time, I was 37 going on 38, but I was out there running with them. Because I wanted them to know that if this almost 40-year-old coach, he's out here and he's in it with us, then it does something to a player. It's like, okay, Coach Lou out here with us, he believes in this enough that, you know, and I'm out there, I'm running with him, I'm huffing and puffing with him, I'm encouraging him, and then I could turn around and use that, say, hey, I'm almost 40. You know, if I can do it, you can do it. Let's do this together. It just worked a different dynamic for me. And I'll always be that kind of coach. Those are just some of the things. And then I have to throw this in here. This is more of a preseason, although there were times we kind of got into this in the regular season. We would do certain things, like there was interval workouts, treadmill workouts that we would do that what it does is you're running at a high RPM. And then when you slow down, you'll go like a quarter of a mile at a high RPM, like at 6.0. Then you'll go down to 5.0. But it's teaching your body how to recover while you're moving. And sometimes in practice, we would do those same kind of things where you do the I can't remember the name that they call it, but it's the Indian run. That's what it is.
Yeah, the Indian run. There you go. Yep,
so there's just different things where we would do those kind of things, but our Indian run was at a whole different level. I mean, it was different.
Hey, coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website, and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit snapraise.com and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time.
All right, tell me what it looked like, because I've coached all my kids' teams, and my son's team, he's now a freshman in high school, but when we were in elementary school, I had an assistant coach who he loved to do the Indian run. And so there was many, many practices where we'd get into the end, and he'd say to me, "Hey, let's do the Indian run." I'm like, "All right, let's do it." And so then you'd get, you know, whatever, our fourth or fifth graders trying to run. For people, I'm assuming most people probably know what the basic idea is, but pretty much what you have is a line of players, and the person in the back has to sprint up to the front and get in front of the line. And we incorporated some free throws and different things in it. But the basic premise is everybody's moving. And at a certain point, when you get to the back of the line, you have to sprint back up to the front of the line. And so it gets to be very tiring depending upon sort of the parameters that you put in front of it. So just give us an idea of what yours looks like.
Yeah. So a lot of times it was the whole line was sprinting, and that back person had to kick it into another gear just to get in front of the line. So it wasn't like everybody go slow.
Right, right.
And, you know, it was just a different kind of speed. It was just a different intensity. And another thing I wanted to mention earlier, too, before I mentioned the Indian run, was a lot of our stuff was timed. And so if you lost a drill, we would do 3-on-3-on-3-on-3 red drills. If you were not the team that won, so you have like four teams that didn't win, they're on the line. You have to, we call them 11s. So you got to make a down and back in the 11. If you don't make it, everybody's on the line and run again, and you run until you make the time. So that produced a different kind of mentality. And when you do that, players will make it, you know, because there's a level inside of all of us that you can attain. You just have to, get pushed, and you have to get put in a situation, a complex situation that's going to make you respond in a different way. So there was never a time that we had a player like, okay, you couldn't make it the first, second time. Okay, well, you know, we're just going to, you didn't make it. No, as a coach. And you know, it's a different time as far as being a coach, but the way I grew up was, we're going to stay here till you make it. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
If we have to go to rest of practice, we're going to be right here. And somewhere I had to find it in me to make that sprint. And that's what helped me to have a success as a player. I did. And I believe that was a part of the success that we had when I was an acting head coach. And I've been a part of teams and been a part of coaching staffs that would just move on. It's like, okay, you didn't make it, okay, that's fine. We'll just move on. But you got to look at the lesson that's being taught there. So now when you're in the championship game and we need this last pressing possession, we need a turnover, where will the player dig deep to get something?
That's exactly right.
They've never been taught to dig deep to get anything that's already there.
you got to put them in that kind of position so that when you get in that championship game, they know how to pull from somewhere to get what they need. And so that was like in a nutshell, our practices were like that.
Yeah. I'm going to give you a little story that happened to me when I was playing at Kent State. And so I can't remember the exact circumstances that led to it. I know there was an unhappy coaching staff for whatever reason, but we had to run ladders, suicides, whatever you want to call them. So we, you know, where you go foul line back, half court back, opposite foul line back, and full court back. And we were running in two groups. So you had the guards were running. Guards had to make that in 28 seconds, and bigs had to make it in 32. And every time that and they were, the guards ran separately from the bigs. So each time a group made it, you got 3 points. And we were going to 75 points. And I think the bigs made the first one, and then I don't think they made another one the rest of the time. So it was kind of left to the guards. So you can kind of do the math in your head of how many times you had to run in order to make that. And I don't think we made every single one. So you're talking probably we ran, I would guess, 30 of those old-fashioned suicides in order to get to that 75 points. And you talk about having to dig deep, especially when you kind of look at your teammates, the bigs, and you're like, come on, fellas, you guys are running in like 38 now. Like, you're not even getting close, and we got to get 28 every single time. But you figure out a way. And to your point, I don't think that back in the day, Coach McDonald, who was our coach at Kent while I was there, you know, he didn't let those things slide, and we just kept going. And he's like, you're going to make it. And then you find out something about yourself, and certainly it's something that in the moment you're like, I think this guy might be crazy. And now I look back on it and it's a great story, but you can certainly see once you shift over from the player side of it to the coach side of it, you understand the lesson that he was trying to get across and teach. And as you said, you kind of alluded to it just for a second there that, you know, times are different and things are certainly not the way they were 30 years ago when I was playing college basketball, and the way that coaches coach and the way we interact with players and do things is different, but there's still something to be said for encouraging your players to dig deep and figuring out a way to get them in the best possible condition, both mentally and physically.
Yeah, definitely. It helps with us being players before, because I always say we know all the tricks. So yeah,
exactly.
Because we've been through it, I can look at a player and know that you're not tired, or You know, you got a little something in you. Like, you know, I've been there. I felt that pain of not wanting to run the next sprint. I felt how it feels like you just want to just fall through the floor. You're so tired. Like, you feel like your stomach is just in your throat somewhere. It's just, I felt that. And so I got through it. And so I know you can. And here's the catch. I'm almost 40 and I'm out here doing it with you now. And so I know you got it in you. So for me, it was never like a tormenting type of thing where I'm just putting you through and I just want to, you know, players think the coaches just want to see them suffer, you know. No, I know you got greatness in you, and I want to help you. I want to help push that out of you. I want you to leave here and bring your kids back, and they can look up and see, hey, mommy or daddy, that's our banner right there. We were a part of that team, you know, and I would always say stuff like that. And so, you know, it just helped fuel them. And like I say, I would get out there with them, and it brought that extra, like, okay, coach is right here. I see coach sweating, coach on his knees, you know, coach, get up, you get up too. You know, it's just a family, and it brings the best out of the players, man. And so, like I say, us being players, we know where they are. And I think even those stories to them, it kind of resonates in their mind and say, you know what? And coach got through it. He's telling them stories. Let me give it one more try. Let me push through this next sprint. And it works, man.
There's no doubt. I think that there's something to be said for getting the most out of your players. And I think that that's something that when you think about what coaching is, it's kind of taking players to a place that they couldn't get to by themselves. And that's your job as a coach. And different coaches have different ways of doing that. And you have to find what works for you? And again, it just goes back to, do you have a philosophy of being a pressing team, or do you have a philosophy of being a half-court man-to-man team, or are you a half-court trap team, or whatever it may be? There's lots of different ways that you can go at it, but ultimately the job of the coach is to get the most out of the players and get the most out of their team. And I think that's what we're both talking about here, is kind of looking at it from the perspective of, hey, when I was a player, I kind of looked at it one way and maybe thought about it in a certain way. And then as a coach, you kind of realize that there's a lot more that goes into some of those decisions that are made in terms of what we do inside and outside of practice to help to best prepare the team and the individual player to win games. Let's go and talk about something else in your book that kind of is a theme that runs through it. And that is, you talk a lot in the book about how you use film to be able to study technique and then transfer that through teaching points out on the court with your own players. So just give us an idea of some of the things when you're watching film, and let's kind of keep it focused on the full court press. What are some things that you look for? Maybe what's a team or a coach that's out there today in today's game that you like to watch to pick up techniques or good things that you could then apply with your teams?
Man, I'll tell you, I probably watched more Gino Auriemma than any coach, because I was, you know, at the time coach of women's basketball. So I watched a ton of Gino, and a lot of him I watched for a lot of offensive things. But they did some pressing as well. So I watched some of that for that. But most of the defensive side came from me as a player when I played. I also watched some, I would say, like some UCLA, because they did some 1-2-2. So, you know, I watched a little bit of them as well. But like I say, I took a lot from when I played, and I kind of did a lot of that. But in terms of film, you know, I showed there was two sources of film. In showing them defensive techniques, I would, like I say, often go to the greats, you know, that when you think about, they were the best to do it or whatever. But in terms of studying the film of an opposing team, you know, I would, man, there was times I'm in the office midnight, 1 o'clock, you know, I lived, you know, steps from the office, you know, so it was easy for me to be there, studying film on synergy and different things like that. But when I would break down a team and study a team, you know, I'm looking for one of the first things, because I just have a defensive mind, and I know our defense really, really wins championships. You know, I was a part of one of them. And so when I study a game, one of the first questions I'm asking before I ask any other question is, who leads their team in turnovers? I want to know who turns the ball over the most. And if they're in their starting lineup, they're in trouble, because we're coming for you. And so when you're looking at keeping the focus on full court press, if they're in that backcourt somewhere, if they're averaging 5 turnovers, we're going to make them get 10 this game. We're going to put more pressure on them than they've ever seen in their life. And so we're going to test those averages. You know, those averages are there for a reason, because it's telling you what they do. And we're going to put that to the test. So if they're averaging 5, that means that's the middle. So they might have gotten games where they're 7, 8, 9. So I'll go look at those games. What did the other team do to make that player, or if you zoom out and say, what did the other team do to make this team average their season high in turnovers? I want to see what they did, because what they did, it worked. And I'm going to take some of that, as well as use our philosophy and make it worse for them. You know, so that's kind of when I started a scout and I'm looking at film, I'm looking for those things. So now I take those things, I take those clips. And so when we go to film session, those are things I'm showing my players. I'm showing my players, hey, this player right here, they're averaging this. They're right hand dominant. Anytime they go to their left, they're quickly crossing back over to their right, because they're not really a good left hand ball handler. I'm breaking it down like that for them, so that when they get in the game, I always say, and I joke around with it, but it's pretty serious, by the time I'm done scouting, I want to know the shoestring color of the player. I want to know every detail. So when I deliver that to my players, they can be confident enough to, when they go and guard that player, they can know that Coach Lou is handing them the keys to success because he's watched that film. And if he say, push that player to the right, he's saying it for a reason. I'm giving them the reason. So they know if they do that, they'll have success. And so we're looking for those kind of things that are going to bring us, you know, if the player gets the ball in bounds, they always look right for that next pass. I'm looking at all those tendencies and you know, we had, you know, the programs that also gave us tendencies like synergy. If you're familiar with that, it's at the college level, it gives you the percentages that a player might drive right. You know, I mean, in a scout, you can't watch all the games. You can watch enough games. A lot of times I watch the last three games and then maybe a key game that, like I say, if that was their high in turnovers, I'll go watch that game. But I also depend on the percentages and synergy of showing what a player tendencies are. And I deliver that to my players. And it made it easy for us a lot because, like I said before, a lot of times if that's a player's average or their percentage, the percentage of their shots are on the right side of the court inside the 3-point, then it's probably going to be like that, you know, at least for the season that you're in. They might change in the off season, but a lot of times those tendencies are right on, spot on for that season, and they don't change a lot, especially at the college level. So we were able to play on that and have great success. So film sessions were great for us. We didn't rush film sessions. We didn't rush to get on the court. A lot of times we went over in film sessions because that was the time where we had to study, and we did a lot of work in there. On the court, we were fine. But if we had to do more time in there to get our players on one accord so they can know mentally what they need to do, we were conditioned well enough athletically and fashioned enough in our game plan of what we were going to do. We were fine, especially when it gets later in the season. But I wanted them to mentally know what to do. So the film sessions were a premium for us.
All right. So I've heard coaches say, and this is one of the things that I think is really important to talk about when it comes to film, is that you have to, as a coach, study that film, get to know your opponents inside and out in terms of what they do, both on the offensive end of the floor and the defensive end of the floor, get to know their personnel. And you have to really, really understand the complexity of what your opponent is all about so that you can make it very, very simple for your players when you share that scouting report with them. Because if you overwhelm players, and you and I both know as players that if somebody hands me a 10-page scouting report, I might read it, but my ability to process that and actually get anything useful that I'm actually going to apply during a game is very minimal. I want just what are some simple actions they're going to do. I want to know a little bit about the player that I'm guarding and their tendencies. And pretty much as a player, I'm not sure that I can process much more than that. But as a coach, I want to be able to know everything that there is to know so that I can simplify and give the player what they need. So maybe talk a little bit about how much film you would watch with players, like in a given day. Like, let's say you're watching film before practice. Is that an everyday thing? And how many minutes are you watching? Just how much of that film are you sharing with players to be able to get across to them what you want to get across to them?
I'll be honest with you too. On that note, a lot of film wasn't the opponent. You know, a lot of film was us, or a lot of film was me sending them, you know, clips of other people. We would go over personnel of a team that we're playing, but that was a very small point because I'm the type of coach that believes in if you do what you do and you do that well, it doesn't matter what the other team does. I want my players to have an idea because, you know, when you look at games, prior games of a team that you're going to play, their prior games, it's a cheat sheet, you know, almost. So you want them to kind of have an idea, but you don't want to focus so much on what the other team's doing that you're not, you know, really honing in on what you're doing. So, for instance, we knew what we did in the full court press. So in a lot of ways, I could care less what a team was doing. We were coming out to do that. And we don't care if you knew we were doing it. You knew it. The whole league knew. So we were coming to do it. And so it was up to you to figure out how you're going to stop what we're doing. So in that case for us, we're not really looking at their press breaker. We might show a couple clips and we're moving on because we know what we're going to do. And we're just giving them a few looks. As far as timing, let's say that we would have games on Tuesdays and Saturdays during the season. So after a Tuesday game, we got Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So our major film session would be the day before. So Friday was the scout practice. And so film would be about an hour. But showing the other team's personnel, it might have been 15 to 30 minutes of that. Depending on our opponent, you know, when you look in the second half of the season, when you're playing opponents twice, it might be less because you kind of seen what they're doing. And as coaches, we're tracking them throughout the season. So we know that, hey, if a team's doing this and we've seen them doing it as we watch in other games, they're probably going to do it against us. So we're just really brushing up on things. But the majority of film is like we might go over our last game to improve what we did or how we can sharpen up different things we're doing. We would also pull in our players. So we will have individual film meetings. So all the guards, I would pull like maybe the 6 or 7 guards in into the office and we'll go over guard duties. We'll pull the bigs in. They may have different assignments depending on what we're playing. And those might be 10 to 15 minute, like between classes, stop in, hey, let's do this. And then we're out. So we didn't bombard them with a lot of it. And then the last one with the film I showed you, we will have individual workouts. So if we were working with a guard, and we were showing them, you know, maybe some in and outs or how to go through a double screen and get the guard on your back. You know, we might have worked on that in practice, but then later on, I would send my player a 8-minute film of Isaiah Thomas with the Boston Celtics doing that very same thing for 8 minutes. And so it's tying in to them that what we just showed you, we didn't make that up. And it brings a pro feel to say, hey, this is. So it just has a way of tying it in with them. It's like coach can show you, but if you show them an NBA player doing it, they're like, oh, okay. You know, so it's yep. just something that we use to help reinforce what we were doing. And so those are the different types of films that we would do.
Do you want to score more? Training with the Shotacle is the easiest way to score more. The game is changing, and data scientists are determining the best ways to score. Millions of computer simulations determine where to hit the backboard for the highest percentage shots, and when it's best to use the backboard. The Shotacle provides those highest percentage shots. From beginners to next-level athletes, the Shotacle is helping players increase their shooting percentages. Visit Shotacle.com now and start scoring more.
When you talk about watching your own film, and obviously there's two ways that you can watch your own film. You can watch positive clips where you say, look, here's what we're trying to accomplish defensively, and we executed it perfectly. And then conversely, you can show clips where, hey, here's where we didn't execute the things that we wanted to do. And so I think as a coach, you want to balance those two out where, you know, you are showing positive clips of what the players are doing, and then you're also showing some things. Well, here's an opportunity for us to learn from a mistake that we made within the game. And it's amazing how much easier watching film is today than it was 15 or 20 years ago. And it's kind of been a running theme through the podcast for, especially for coaches who are a little bit older that grew up in an era of VCRs and going and, you know, mailing VHS tapes and meeting on the road to exchange tapes with other, you know, with other coaches. It's a totally different world now what you can go through it. And to that, speaking to that, the next section in your book talks about 3-point field goal defense. And we all know that the game has shifted dramatically in the last 10 years to where the 3-point field goal has become so much more an important part of the game than it was even 10 years ago. And where 10 years ago, you might have had a handful of teams that were shooting a lot of threes. At this point, the game has pretty much shifted where everybody is shooting a lot of threes, and you better be able to defend that. So just talk a little bit about the philosophy that you have defending the 3-point field goal and what you can do as a coach to get out and defend the 3-point line.
Yeah. So man, one of my pet peeves, oh my gosh, is to see, you know, I was watching a game, I looked back over a game. I didn't get to watch it. I watched highlights and went back to the stats or whatever. And I saw a team, they got beat, but the team went 12 for 26 from the 3-point line against him. And I'm like, my gosh, like, you know, it's one thing when you make 3, 4, maybe 5 against me, but that can happen. But if you're making 12 on me, okay, I'm not doing my job now. Like, there, it's not that, oh, you're good. It's that I'm not playing defense.
Absolutely.
And when you break that down, 12 3-pointers, that's 36 points. And if a team scores 75 points, that's half the points almost. It's like, you deserve to lose. You deserve to lose the game. And I think that will continue to happen. And you see it all the time, you know, that will continue to happen until coaches decide to put a premium on 3-point line defense. Always say it like this. If the NCAA is tracking the stat, you know, there's a lot of stats that the NCAA, they don't track. But if you can look on the NCAA website and they're tracking 3-point field goal defense, this is important.
You know, absolutely.
Because they're not going to waste the money to track that. And so if they think it's important, I'm going to think it's important. And so I became the type of coach that I said, we're not going to lose games because we're not getting out on the 3-point line. It is very hard for an offensive player to shoot a 3-pointer with accuracy if there's a defender there getting the hand up in the face or trying to block the shot. It's impossible. Or if, you know, for me, if you're hugging the 3-point line, that's going to push you out. And so we worked on those kind of things. We worked on them in our shell drills. You know, we made it a premium that when that ball's in flight, you have to be moving. And when that ball is caught, if they catch it, you need to be in front of them waiting for them. And so we worked on quickness. We did footwork drills and the conditioning that takes the quickness and the speed to get there so that teams are not just getting open 3-pointers on us. In transition drills, a lot of teams like to float that player to the 3-point line. Well, we knew that. We was ready for that kind of stuff. So getting back, that's where we knew we had to be. And so when scouting a team, you know if they're a 3-point shooting team. You know how they win their games. If you know that they're winning their games by 3-pointers, then your scout should be full of guarding the 3-point line. And so for us, we hugged the 3-point line. Our defensive stance was on the 3-point line. So that makes you have to shoot further than the 3-point line. You can't be snugged and comfortable right behind the line shooting 3-pointers. We were not going to let you do that. And so we worked that. We worked it over and over and over. It was an important part of our practice. And at the end of the year, we were not as high as we wanted to be. A lot of the premium went in other places. We were 27th in the nation. But, you know, if you look back at our season, teams didn't beat us by just spraying us with 3-pointers. It just wasn't happening. And so, you know, when you look at all the aspects of the game, that was for sure one aspect that we wanted to have a handle on because, you know, 3 points is more than two. We don't want to reward teams with 3-pointers just because we were not playing defense. So we wanted to make sure we were on top of that so that we could take that factor out in terms of that was a way a team beat us. And, you know, you can look across conferences. You know, the last place I coached, it was able to in D1 conference. You can look across the conference and tell the teams that were 3-point shooting teams. And those are the teams you had to be ready for. And a lot of times we were ready for those teams and almost kind of cut the head off the snake. Like that's what they depended on. We took that away. We beat them. And it's that simple. So we tried to keep it simple, man, like that. And we won a lot of games because of it.
Yeah, it's so important in today's game. I don't think there's any way that you can have a defensive philosophy and not have some type of focus on, hey, we got to take away and limit. Just like offenses today are, you think about the Houston Rockets philosophy and the, you know, we want to shoot threes, layups, and free throws. And to some degree, I think a lot of coaches have adopted that philosophy. Obviously, in the college game, it's a little bit more difficult to play completely that way, and you have players that aren't quite as skilled as they are in the NBA. But nonetheless, there certainly is a different shot profile over the course of a game than what you would have seen in a game 20 years ago. And so as a coach, you have to make that adjustment. And you have, as you said, you got to work on that every day. You got to talk about what it means to be there on the catch so that you're taking away those catch and shoot threes, which are obviously the easiest ones for most players to be able to make. If you put them, have a college player, especially, or a high school player, put the ball on the floor and then shoot a three, their percentage, I don't know what exactly it would be, but it certainly goes down. And so you want to make sure that you have that three-point defense buckled down and making sure that you're doing something with that every single day in your practices. The last section of the book, Lewis, you talk about post-player defense, and you have a concept there of putting down some meet and greet lines on the floor to help your players to better understand what you want them to do when defending the post. So talk a little bit about that. It's something that I had not heard or seen anybody else do. So just talk a little bit about what that is all about and how that helps you to play better post defense with your teams.
So when I was at Central State, man, I used to go down to Ohio State practices all the time. My guy, Mark Mitchell, he's opened the door for me. And so I would go sit in their practices, man. And one of the things I noticed, man, there was tape all over the floor. I'm talking about, man, it was tape everywhere. You know? So I got to asking them about different things, man. And so literally I took those concepts back to Central State and I started taping the floor and a lot of our defensive concepts, you know, in terms of where players need to be, where the open windows were, just different things, where the slide lines were. So it just kind of helped the concepts, you know. It's just something that visually, if I'm trying to explain something and I can show you where the spacing is, it just kind of helps, you know. So kind of took those concepts, man, with me to Winthrop, where I was associate head coach there. And I probably broke a record, I think, in my mind, I always say that, for ordering tape. We had boxes and boxes of tape, different colors and everything. And so one day while taping the floor, you know, I was over bigs. And, you know, in our post player breakdown or guard breakdown, I would take the post players. And so I worked with them. And so one day I was just doing it, man. And I said, you know what? Like, I was explaining to them the concept, but it kind of came to me like, you know what? Why don't I create a line for this? So that, how can I illustrate this to them by taping the floor? And it just came to me to do it. And I started calling it the meet and greet. You know, we did a lot of meet and greets in college. You know, the coaches, you know, we have a meet and greet at the president's, you know, home, or the meet and greet when the players come on official visits or whatever, you know. And it, so it just came a kind of, it came to my mind as a catchy thing. I was like, you know what? We're calling this the meet and greet line. And so the concept behind it is, you don't want to let, as a post defender, you don't want to let a post player just come and just set up wherever they want. If you just let them come to the block and set up, that's going to make it easy for them. It's going to make it harder for you because they're in position. But the further you push them out of position, the harder it's going to be for them, unless they're like a Dirk or, you know, somebody that can, like, they're an inside out player. A lot of times, especially in our league, you didn't find that. And so we didn't want a player to sit up comfortably on the block. So we wanted to meet them coming down the floor as far out as we could. And so we created that line off of the block. We call it the meet and greet line. You have to meet and greet your defender coming down the floor at that line. And it'll be up to them to fight for position from there. But we were not going to let them come down and comfortably just set up on the block. That's too close to the basket. So that was the meet and greet line. And we put that down every practice. And, you know, when you put lines on the court during practice, you know, it's just going to get ingrained in the player's mind. So during the game, you're remembering that even though the line's not there. When I put this line down, we don't want a player to come down court and set up on the block. We want them to set up away from the block, and it's going to make it harder for them to score and get in position like they want, which is also going to take their percentage down because they're going to try to make moves that they're not comfortable with. It just does a number of things. And, you know, it just created advantages for us and disadvantages for the defense. And so this is just a concept that we had that really, really helped us a lot. And just sharing it in the book, you know, post defense is a big thing. It's a huge thing. And, you know, it prevents you know, a lot of teams you'll see, I was looking at some stats over another game, and this team had 40 plus points in the paint. And I'm like, oh, you know, I hate to see that. But this kind of concept for us helped us to limit a team's points in the paint, because statistically and, you know, percentage wise, it takes away some of those opportunities because you're pushing a player out. It just takes away some of those opportunities. So this helped us in that kind of situation where a team might be scoring a lot of points in the paint. We're going to push them off the block and make them have to react to what we're doing instead of letting them get comfortable shots like they want to.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And when you talk about trying to keep a team from scoring a lot of points in the paint, it goes back to what we just talked about a second ago with shooting and trying to get run teams off the three-point line. You got to understand what your opponent is trying to do and where their strengths are, and then make them do something else. And if you can teach these concepts of how to defend the three-point line, you can teach how to play in the post and try to prevent your player from getting good position. When you can get out in the full court press and you can disrupt their offense and what they want to do, now you're really starting to build the type of defensive philosophy and the type of defensive team where your defense can be what drives winning. And I think that's the main overarching point that you were trying to get across throughout the book. In addition to the X's and O's that are a piece of it, it really comes down to you have to develop your philosophy. You have to be able to teach it to your players. And then once you've done those two things, it gives you the opportunity to be a strong defensive team, which can obviously lead to winning on the scoreboard. So before we wrap up, Lewis, I want to give you a chance to, one, tell people about where they can get the book. Two, tell us about some of the other things that you have going on right now in terms of being able to help coaches and allow them to improve themselves, and how you're trying to give back to the coaching profession right now in what you're doing as an entrepreneur, as a coach, as a guy who loves the game of basketball. So just kind of give us the quick synopsis of what you're up to right now and then where people can find the book.
Right now, you know, with not actively being in coaching, you know, I just, in keeping myself relevant, you know, I've been mentoring coaches at every level. You know, I've also had an amazing opportunity to be able to go in and talk to coaches, that including I've been to, you know, cities where I've done 2-day symposiums with one, like a particular team or two, and just going in and, you know, looking at their practice, monitoring that, you know, having individual meetings with the players, you know, having a session with the coaches, talking strategy for the season. You know, I've been, you know, I've done a lot of those things. I've done, when before COVID, pregame talks, you know, those kind of things as well. So, as well as mentoring coaches all over, had an opportunity just to be on phone calls with 30-minute sessions with coaches, just talking through strategy, answering questions, helping them to come up with a strategy for their team, whether that's a on the court, off the court, team building, those kind of things, just ways to fortify their team a little more in terms of their goals. Just done a lot of those things. And so I'm doing a lot of that, as well as have created a lot of different tools for coaches, one being this book. But I've also on my website have a lot of different tools, file timeout charts, templates for scouting, different things like that. So just been trying to, as well as on my site, I have a link now with free resources. So I put a lot of videos up there just of individual workouts I did in college and just different things. Coaches can go there and just grab things for free, different concepts. So just been busy just trying to bring value to the coaching space. And because I'm not able to do what I would do normally on the court and in practice, I'm just sharing some of the concepts that I've learned over time as not only a coach, but a pro player and college D1 player, and just trying to help the space, man. You know, people have helped me, and I just want to give back to coaches, especially those younger ones. Even with the younger ones, I've created a new and aspiring coaches webinar. It's a 3-video webinar. Each video has a PDF that goes along with it with notes and stuff like that. So that's on my website as well. So I've just tried to create those things to help coaches. And as far as with my book, you can find my book on my website, lewisshine.com. You can click on coaches and you'll see the book there. Or if you want to go to the direct link, it's lewisshine.com/defense ebook. You can find the book there as well. We'll love your support. We'll love to get it into the coaches' hands that are listening. I think it'll be a great resource for your team.
Lewis, we cannot thank you enough for jumping back on with us for a second time. And any coaches that are out there, if you get a chance to check out Lewis's stuff, as he said, one of the things I love about what he does is he's putting out a lot of resources that you can access for free that can help you to improve your coaching. And I hope that you'll support him and go out and find his book. Go to lewisshine.com. Check out all the great things that he has to offer. We really appreciate you, Lewis, jumping back on with us. It was fun to go into a little bit of a deeper dive into some X's and O's on defense and talk a little bit of a philosophy and that kind of thing. So we really are thankful that you decided to join us again. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.